This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents Metro 2034. Written by Dmitry Glukhovsky. Narrated by Rupert Degas. The world of Metro 2034. The entire world lies in ruins. The human race has been almost completely wiped out. Radiation renders half-ruined cities uninhabitable, and rumors say that beyond the city limits, there is nothing but boundless expanses of scorched deserts and dense thickets of mutated forest. But no one knows what really is out there. As civilization draws its final shuddering breaths, memories of humankind's former glory are already obscured by a thick fog of fantasy and fiction. More than 20 years have passed since the day when the final plane took off. Corroded, rust-pitted railway tracks lead off into nowhere. The great construction projects of the final great age lie in ruins, destined never to be completed. The airwaves are empty. And when radio operators tune in, for the millionth time, to the frequencies on which New York, Paris, Tokyo, and Buenos Aires once used to broadcast, all they hear is a vague, distant howling. It is only 20 years since it happened, but man is no longer the master of the Earth. New creatures, born of the radiation, are far better adapted to this new world than human beings. The human era is almost over. Those who refuse to believe it are very few, numbering mere tens of thousands. They do not know if anyone else has been saved, or if they are the last people left on the planet. They live in the Moscow Metro, the largest nuclear bomb shelter ever built, in the final refuge of the human race. On that day, they were all in the Metro, and that was what saved their lives. Now, hermetic seals protect them against radiation and monsters from the surface. Decrepit but functional filters purify their water and air. Dynamos built by amateur engineers generate electricity. Underground farms cultivate mushrooms and breed pigs. But the central control system of the Metro disintegrated long ago, and its stations have become dwarf states, each with a population united by its own ideology and religion, or merely by loyalty to the water filters. This is a world without any tomorrow. There is no place in it for dreams, plans, and hopes. Here, instincts take priority over feelings. And the most powerful instinct of all is survival. Survival at any price. What happened before the events recounted in this book is described in the novel Metro 2033. Chapter 1. The Defense of Sebastopol. They didn't come back on Tuesday or Wednesday or even Thursday, which had been set as the final deadline. Armored checkpoint number 1 was on 24-hour alert, and if the men on watch had caught even a faint echo of appeals for help or spotted even a pale glimmer of light on the dark, damp walls of the tunnel, a search and rescue unit would have been dispatched immediately in the direction of Nakhimov Prospekt. With every hour that passed, the tension grew more palpable. The finest combat troops, superbly equipped and specially trained for exactly this kind of mission, hadn't grabbed a single moment of shut-eye all night long. The deck of cards that was used to while away the time from one alert to the next had been gathering dust in a drawer of the duty room desk for almost 2 days. The usual joshing and banter had first given way to uneasy conversations in low voices, and then to heavy silence, every man hoping to be the first to hear the echoing footsteps of the returning convoy. Far too much depended on it. Everyone at Sebastopol could handle a weapon, from a 5-year-old boy to the very oldest man. The inhabitants of the station had transformed it into an impregnable bastion, bristling with machine gun nests, coils of prickly barbed wire, and even anti-tank hedgehogs welded together out of rails. But this fortress station, which seemed so invulnerable, could fall at any moment. Its Achilles heel was a chronic shortage of ammunition. Faced with what the inhabitants of Sebastopol had to endure on a daily basis, the inhabitants of any other station wouldn't even have thought of defending it. They would have fled from the place like rats from a flooding tunnel. After tallying up the costs involved, probably not even mighty Hansa, the alliance of stations on the Circle Line, would have chosen to commit the forces required to defend Sebastopol Station. Despite its undeniable strategic significance, the price was far too high. But electric power was very expensive. Expensive enough for the Sebastopolites, who had constructed one of the largest hydroelectric stations in the metro, to order ammunition by the crate with the income earned from supplying power to Hansa and still remain in profit. For many of them, however, the price paid for this was counted, not only in cartridges, but in their own crippled and shortened lives. Groundwaters were the blessing and the curse of Sebastopol Station, flowing round it on all sides, like the waters of the Styx round Charon's fragile bark. They turned the blades of dozens of watermills constructed by self-taught engineers in tunnels, caverns, and underground watercourses, everywhere that the engineering exploration teams could reach, generating light and warmth for the station itself, and also for a good third of the circle. These same waters incessantly eroded support structures and gnawed away at cement joints, murmuring drowsily just behind the walls of the main hall, trying to lull the inhabitants into a false sense of security. And they also made it impossible to blow up the superfluous, unused side tunnels, from out of which hordes of nightmare creatures advanced on Sebastopol Station like an endless millipede creeping into a meat grinder. The inhabitants of the station, the crew of this ghostly frigate hurtling through the nether regions of the underworld, were doomed eternally to seek out and patch over new breaches in the hull of their vessel. It had begun springing leaks long ago, but there was no safe haven where it could rest in peace from its labors. And at the same time, they had to repel attempt after attempt to board their vessel by monsters from the Chertanovo and Nakhimov Prospect stations, creeping out of ventilation shafts, percolating through drains with rapid streams of turbid water erupting out of the southern tunnels. The whole world seemed to have ganged up against the Sebastopolites in a bitter determination to wipe their home off the map of the metro. And yet they clung to their station obdurately, as if it were all that remained of the universe. But no matter how skillful the engineers of Sebastopol Station were, no matter how experienced and pitiless the soldiers trained there might be, they could not effectively defend their home without ammunition, without bulbs for the floodlights, without antibiotics and bandages. Yes, the station generated electric power, and Hansa was willing to pay a good price for it. But the Circle had other suppliers too, and resources of its own, whereas the Sebastopolites could hardly have held out a month without a flow of supplies from the outside. And the most frightening prospect of all was to be left without ammunition. Heavily guarded convoys set out to Serpukhov Station every week to purchase everything that was needed, using the credit arranged with Hansa merchants, and then, without delaying a single hour more than necessary, they set off back home again. And as long as the world kept on turning, and the underground rivers flowed, and the vaults erected by the metro's builders held up, the order of things was expected to continue unchanged. But the latest convoy had been delayed. Delayed beyond any reasonable limit, long enough for the realization to dawn that this time something terrible and unforeseen had happened, something against which not even heavily armed battle-hardened guards and a relationship built up over the years with the leadership of Hansa had been able to protect it. And all this would not have been so bad if only the lines of communication were functioning. But something had happened to the telephone line that led to the Circle. Contact had been broken off on Monday, and the team sent out to search for the break had drawn a blank. The lamp with the broad green shade hung down low over the round table, illuminating yellowed pieces of paper with graphs and diagrams drawn in pencil. The little bulb was weak, only 40 watts, not because of any need to save electric power, but because the occupant of the office was not fond of bright light. The ashtray, overflowing with stubs from the atrocious local hand-rolled cigarettes, exuded an acrid bluish smoke that gathered in viscous clouds, stirring lazily under the ceiling. The station commandant rubbed his forehead, then jerked his hand away and glanced at the dial of the clock with his only eye for the fifth time in the last half hour. He cracked his finger joints and rose ponderously to his feet.
"We have to decide. No point in putting it off any longer."
The robust-looking old man sitting opposite him in a military camouflage jacket and threadbare sky-blue beret opened his mouth to speak, but instantly started coughing. He drove away the smoke with a sharp flap of his hand, frowned in annoyance, and replied,
"Then let me tell you again, Vladimir Ivanovich, we can't take anyone off the south side. The guard posts are already struggling to hold out under this kind of pressure. In the last week alone, they've had 3 men wounded, 1 critically. And that's despite the reinforcements. I won't let you weaken the south side. And apart from that, they need 2 teams of 3 scouts to patrol the shafts and connecting tunnels. And as for the north, apart from the soldiers from the reception team, we don't have any men to spare. I'm sorry, you'll have to find them somewhere else."
"You're the commanding officer of the perimeter. You find them," snapped the station commandant. "And I'll handle my own business. But the team has to set out in 1 hour. What you need to grasp is that we're thinking in different categories here. We have to look beyond solving the immediate problems. What if it's something really serious out there?"
"I think you're getting ahead of yourself, Vladimir Ivanovich. We've got 2 unopened crates of 5.45 caliber in the arsenal. That's enough for a week and a half, for certain. And I've got more lying around under my pillow at home."
The old man laughed, baring his strong yellow teeth.
"I can scrape together a crate for sure. The problem's not the ammunition. It's the men."
"I'll tell you what the problem is. We've got 2 weeks to get our supplies in order before we have to close the hermetic doors in the southern tunnels, because we won't be able to hold them without ammunition. That means we won't be able to inspect and repair 2/3 of our mills. A week after that, they'll start breaking down. Nobody will be happy about disruptions in the power supply to Hansa. If we're lucky, they'll just start looking for other suppliers, and if we're not... But the power's not the worst of it. The tunnels have been totally deserted for almost 5 days now. Nobody, not a single man. What if there's been a cave-in? What if we've been cut off?"
"Ah, come on. The power cables are in good order. The little numbers are spinning on the meters, the current's flowing, Hansa's consuming it. If there was a cave-in, you'd know straight away. Even supposing it was sabotage, they'd have cut our cables, not the phone. And as for the tunnels, who's going to come down them now? Even in good times, no one's ever strolled down here just to be sociable. Nakhimov Prospect is bad enough without throwing all the rest in. No one can get through it on his own. The merchants from other stations don't stick their noses in here any longer, and the bandits obviously know about us. We did the right thing, letting one go alive every time. I'm telling you, don't panic."
"It's easy for you to talk,"
growled Vladimir Ivanovich, lifting the bandage off his empty eye socket and wiping away the sweat that had sprung out on his forehead.
"I'll give you a team of 3 men. Honestly, I simply can't give you any more yet,"
the old man said, speaking more calmly now.
"And stop smoking, will you? You know I can't breathe that stuff, and you're poisoning yourself. Why don't you just get us some tea?"
"That's something we can always manage,"
said the commandant, rubbing his hands together.
"Istomin here,"
he growled into the telephone receiver.
"Tea for me and the colonel."
"And summon the duty officer,"
said the perimeter commander, taking the beret off his head.
"I'll give the instructions about those 3 men."
Istomin's tea was always the same, from the Economic Achievement Station, a special select variety. Not many could afford that sort of thing, delivered from the far side of the metro and charged duty 3 times along the way by Hansa's customs posts. The Commandant's beloved beverage was getting to be so expensive, even he would have stopped indulging his weakness if not for his old contacts at Dobrynin Station. He once fought side by side with someone there, and ever since then, every month without fail, the commander of the convoy returning from Hansa had brought a bright-colored bundle, which Istomin came to collect in person. A year ago, however, supplies of the tea had become unreliable. Alarming rumors reached Sebastopol station of a terrible new danger menacing the economic achievement station, perhaps even the entire Orange Line. New mutants of a type never seen before had come down from the surface, and supposedly they could read people's thoughts, were almost invisible, and even worse, virtually impossible to kill. Some said the station had fallen, and Hansa, fearing an incursion, had blown up the tunnel beyond Peace Prospect station. The prices for tea soared, and then it disappeared completely, and Istomin had been seriously alarmed. But a few weeks later the frenzy subsided, and the convoys returning to Sebastopol station with ammunition and electric light bulbs started delivering the aromatic beverage again. And what could possibly be more important than that? As he poured the perimeter commander's tea into a china cup with a chipped gold border, Istomin squeezed his eyes shut for an instant, breathing in the fragrant steam. Then he strained some tea out for himself, sat down heavily in his chair, and stirred in a tablet of saccharin, tinkling his little silver spoon. Neither of them spoke, and for 30 seconds or so this melancholy tinkling was the only sound to be heard in the dark office, wreathed in tobacco smoke. But suddenly, the tinkling was drowned out by a different sound, in almost exactly the same rhythm that came hurtling out of the tunnel, the jangling of the alarm bell.
The alarm!
The perimeter commander leapt up off his chair with incredible agility for a man of his age, and darted out of the room. Somewhere in the distance there was the crack of a single rifle shot, immediately overtaken by the chatter of machine guns, one, two, three of them. Metal-tipped soldiers' boots clattered along the platform, and from somewhere far away came the bass rumble of the colonel's voice barking out orders. Istomin also reached for the gleaming militia machine gun that was hanging by the cupboard, but then he gasped and clutched at his waist, flapped his hand helplessly, went back to the table, and took a sip of tea. The perimeter commander's abandoned cup was standing there, cooling on the table in front of him, with the light blue beret lying beside it, forgotten in the colonel's haste. The station commandant grinned sourly at the beret, and started arguing in a low voice with the commander who had bolted, coming back again and again to the same old topics with new arguments that he hadn't thought of while they were wrangling face to face. It was a constant subject of somber jokes at Sebastopol, the similarity of the next station's name, Tsertanova, to the Russian word for a demon, Tsert. The watermill generators were scattered deep into the tunnels between the two metro stations, but nobody even dreamed of making things more convenient by occupying and developing vacant Tsertanova, in the same way as Kakhovka station adjacent to Sebastopol had been annexed. The undercover engineering teams who crept closest to it in order to install and inspect the more distant generators didn't dare approach within 100 meters of the platform. Apart from the most hard-bitten atheists, almost all the men setting out on an expedition like that crossed themselves furtively, and some even said goodbye to their families just in case. There was something bad about that station, and everyone who came within 0.5 kilometer could sense it. The heavily armed detachments that the Sebastopolites, in their ignorance, dispatched to Tsertanova when they were still hoping to expand their territory, had sometimes returned battered and crushed, with their numbers reduced by half, but most often they hadn't returned at all. Some battle-hardened soldiers had come back so badly frightened that they hiccuped and drooled and trembled uncontrollably, even sitting so close to the campfire that their clothes began to smolder. They struggled to recall what they had been through, but one man's recollection was never like another's. The generally accepted explanation was that somewhere beyond Tsertanova station, the side branches of the main tunnels dived downwards, weaving their way into a colossal labyrinth of natural caves, rumored to be teeming with all sorts of loathsome creatures. At the station, this place was referred to provisionally as the Gates, only provisionally because none of the living inhabitants of Sebastopol Station had ever seen it. There was, of course, the well-known incident in the early days when the line was still being explored and the gates were apparently discovered by a large reconnaissance team that had managed to get through Chertanovo Station. They were carrying a communications device, something like a landline telephone. On this device, the signal officer reported to Sebastopol Station that the scouts were standing at the entrance to a wide corridor that descended in an almost vertical incline. His voice was cut off before he could add anything else. But for several minutes after that, until the cable was snapped, the commanding officers of Sebastopol Station huddled round the intercom, listening, as the soldiers of the reconnaissance team screamed in diabolical horror and agony, until one by one, their screams were cut short. Nobody even attempted to fire, as if every one of the dying men realized that ordinary weapons couldn't possibly protect them. The last one to fall silent was the commanding officer of the group, a cutthroat Chinese mercenary from Kitaigorod Station, who collected the little fingers of his dead enemies. He was evidently some distance away from the telephone receiver dropped by the signal officer, and it was hard to make out what he was saying. But concentrating hard on the man sobbing as he died, the station commandant recognized a prayer, the simple, naive kind of prayer that parents who believe teach their little children to say. After that incident, they had abandoned all attempts to push beyond Chertanovo Station, and were even planning to abandon Sebastopol and join Hansa. But the accursed Chertanovo seemed to be the frontier post marking the precise outer boundary of the human domain in the metro. Creatures that infiltrated beyond it were a cause of serious annoyance to the Sebastopolites. But at least they could be killed, and with a properly organized defense, these attacks could be repelled relatively easily and almost without human bloodshed, provided there was enough ammunition. The monsters that crept up to the sentry posts were sometimes so large that they could only be stopped with explosive bullets and high-voltage discharge traps. But most of the time, the sentries had to deal with beasts that were less frightening, although they were extremely dangerous. These beasts had been given the name of a vampire monster out of a book by Gogol, a word that sounded almost affectionate, like the name of a household pet, Upir.
"There's another one! Up on top, in the third pipe!"
The searchlight, torn off its ceiling anchors, dangled jerkily on a single wire, flooding the space in front of the guard post with harsh white light, picking out the contorted figures of the mutants who were lurking in the shadows, then plunging them back into impenetrable gloom, then glaring blindingly into the eyes of the sentries. Blurred, quivering shadows heaved and surged on all sides, shrinking back and springing forward, slanting and twisting. Men cast shadows like fiends, fiends cast shadows like men. The guard post was very conveniently located at a point where the tunnels converged. Shortly before the final war, the Metro Construction Concern had launched a renovation program that was never completed. At this node, the Sebastopolites had set up a genuine little fortress, two machine gun positions, a barricade of sandbags that was a meter and a half thick, anti-tank hedgehogs and booms on the tracks, electrical traps on the close approaches, and a carefully planned signaling system. But when the mutants advanced en masse, as they did on that day, it seemed that with just a little more pressure, the defenses would collapse. A machine gunner stared in amazement at his scarlet-soaked hands, breathing out bubbles of blood through his nose and muttering something in a vague, monotonous tone. The air round his jammed pechenegg was quivering with heat haze. He snorted briefly and fell quiet, nestling his face trustingly against the shoulder of the next man, a massive warrior wearing an enclosed titanium helmet. The next second, a blood-curdling shriek rang out ahead of them, as an upir launched into the attack. The warrior in the helmet rose up above the parapet, pushing aside the bloodied machine gunner who had tumbled onto him, flung up his submachine gun, and fired a long burst. The repulsive, sinewy, matte grey beast had already flung itself forward, stretching out its knotty front limbs and gliding downwards on taut, stretched folds of skin. The upirs moved with incredible speed, and anyone who hesitated had absolutely no chance. Only men with the nimblest feet and fastest hands stood duty on this watch. The whiplash of lead cut the shriek short, but the dead creature continued falling by inertia, and its 100-kilogram carcass slammed into the barricade with a dull thud, throwing up a cloud of dust from the sandbags.
"Looks like that's it."
Only 2 minutes ago, the torrent of gruesome creatures gushing out of the immense sawn-off pipes suspended under the ceiling had seemed endless, but now it had dried up. The sentries started cautiously picking their way out from behind the defenses.
"Get a stretcher! A doctor! Get him to the station, quick!"
The husky fighter, who had killed the final upir, attached a bayonet to the barrel of his automatic weapon, and started walking unhurriedly round the dead and wounded creatures littering the battlefield, giving each one a kick in its toothy jaw with the toe of his boot, and thrusting the bayonet swiftly and deftly into its eye. Finally, when he'd finished, he leaned back wearily against the sandbags, raised the visor of his helmet, and pressed a flask to his lips. Reinforcements arrived from the station after it was all over. The commander of the perimeter also arrived, with his private's monkey jacket unbuttoned, breathing hard and cursing his old aches and pains.
"Where am I supposed to find him 3 men? Rip them out of my own flesh?"
"What are you talking about, Denis Mikhailovich?" asked one of the sentries, peering into his commander's face incredulously.
"Istomin insists we send a team of 3 scouts to Serpukhov. He's worried about the convoy, but where am I going to get 3 men for him, especially right now?"
"So there's still no news about the convoy?"
asked the large man who was quenching his thirst without turning round.
"Not a word," the old man confirmed. "But it hasn't really been all that long yet, which is more dangerous when you really get down to it. If we strip the south naked today in a week's time, there'll be no one left to meet that convoy."
The husky warrior swayed his head without speaking, and he didn't respond when the commander carried on muttering for a few minutes and asked the sentries at the post if anyone wanted to volunteer for the team he would have to assign to an expedition to Serpukhov station, otherwise the station commandant, damn him to hell, would have the old man's bald head. There were no problems with selecting volunteers. Many of the sentries were already tired of being stuck here, and it was hard for them to imagine anything more dangerous than defending the southern tunnels. Of the 6 men who put themselves forward for the expedition, the colonel selected those who, in his opinion, Sebastopol needed least, and this turned out to be a good choice, because none of the 3 men who were dispatched to Serpukhov ever returned to the station. For 3 days now, ever since the scouts had set out in search of the convoy, the colonel had imagined whispering behind his back and sidelong glances from all directions. Even the most animated conversations broke off when he walked by, and in the tense silence that fell wherever he appeared, he seemed to hear an unspoken demand to explain and justify himself. He was simply doing his job, maintaining the security of the defensive perimeter of Sebastopol Station. He was a tactician, not a strategist. When every soldier counted, the colonel had no right to squander men by sending them out on missions that were dubious or even entirely pointless. 3 days ago, the colonel had been absolutely convinced of that. But now, when he could feel on his own back the lash of every frightened, disapproving, doubting look, his certainty had been shaken. Travelling light, the team should have taken less than 24 hours to cover the distance to Hansa and back, even allowing for any possible skirmishes and waits at the borders of independent way stations. And that meant giving orders for no one to be allowed in. The colonel locked himself in his little room and started muttering, going over for the 100th time all the possible versions of what could have happened to the traders and the scouts. At Sebastopol, they weren't afraid of people, apart from the Hansa army, that is. The station's bad reputation, the stories of the price its inhabitants paid for survival, first told by a few eyewitnesses, then taken up and exaggerated over and over in the telling by shuttle traders and people who liked to listen to their tall tales, had spread right through the metro and done their work. Quick to realize the usefulness of this kind of reputation, the station's commanders had done their best to reinforce it. Agents, travelers, members of convoys, and diplomats were given an official blessing to lie in the most terrible terms possible about Sebastopol station, and in general about everything that came after the Serpukhov stretch of the line. Only a few individuals were capable of seeing through this smoke screen to perceive the station's appeal and genuine significance. In recent years, there had only been one or two attacks by ignorant bandits attempting to force their way in past the guard posts, and the superbly well-tuned Sebastopol war machine had decimated the isolated bands without the slightest difficulty. Nevertheless, before setting off on its reconnaissance mission, the three-man team had been clearly instructed that if any threat of danger arose, they should not engage the enemy but come back as quickly as possible. Of course, there was Nagornaya Station, a less malign place than Chartanovo, but still very dangerous and sinister, and the Nakhimov Prospekt Station, with its upper hermetic door stuck open, which meant it couldn't be completely closed off against infiltration from the surface. The Sebastopolites didn't want to detonate the exits there. Nakhimov Prospekt's ascent was used by the local stalkers. No one would ever venture to make his way alone through the Prospekt, as it was known at the station, but there had never been a case when a team of three men had been unable to repel the beasts they encountered there. A cave-in, a groundwater breach, sabotage, undeclared war with Hansa. Now it was the colonel, and not Istomin, who had to give answers to the wives of the scouts who had disappeared, when they came to him, gazing into his eyes with weary yearning like abandoned dogs, seeking for some kind of promise or consolation in those eyes. He had to explain everything to the garrison soldiers, who never asked unnecessary questions while they still believed in him. He had to reassure all the alarmed people who gathered in the evening after work by the station clock that had noted the precise time of the convoy's departure. Istomin said that in the last few days, people kept asking him again and again why the lights had been dimmed at the station and demanding that the lamps be turned back up as bright as before. But in fact, no one had even thought of reducing the voltage, and the lamps were burning at full power. The gathering darkness was not in the station, but in people's hearts, and not even the very brightest mercury lamps could dispel it. Telephone communications with Serpukhov still hadn't been restored, and during the week that had passed since the convoy left, the colonel, like many other Sebastopolites, had lost a very important feeling, one that was rare for inhabitants of the metro, the sense of close companionship with other people. As long as the lines of communication functioned, as long as convoys traveled to and fro regularly, and the journey to Hansa took less than a day, everyone living at Sebastopol Station had been free to leave or to stay. Everyone knew that only 5 stops away from their station lay the beginning of the genuine metro. Civilization. The human race. It was probably the way polar explorers used to feel, abandoned in the Arctic after voluntarily condemning themselves to long months of battling the cold and loneliness for the sake of scientific research or high pay. The mainland was thousands of kilometers away, but somehow it was still close, as long as the radio worked and every month the rumbling of a plane's engines could be heard overhead and crates of canned meat came floating down on parachutes. But now, the ice floe on which their station stood had broken away, and with every hour that passed it was being swept further and further out into an icy blizzard in a black ocean, into the void of the unknown. The waiting dragged on, and the colonel's vague concern for the fate of the scout sent to Serpukhov was gradually transformed into the somber certainty that he would never see those men again. He simply couldn't afford to take 3 more soldiers off the defensive perimeter and fling them after the others to face the same unknown danger and most likely certain death. But the idea of closing the hermetic doors, cutting off the southern tunnels, and assembling a large strike force still seemed premature to him. If only someone else would make the decision now. Any decision was foredoomed to prove wrong. The perimeter commander sighed, opened the door slightly, looked around furtively, and called over a sentry.
How about letting me have a cigarette? But this is the last one. Don't give me any more, not even if I beg you, and don't tell anyone, all right?
Nadia, a thick-set, talkative woman in a fluffy dress with holes in it and a dirty apron, brought a hot casserole of meat and vegetables, and the sentries livened up a bit. Potatoes, cucumbers, and tomatoes were regarded as very great delicacies here. Apart from Sebastopol Station, the only places where you could feast on vegetables were one or two of the finest restaurants of the Circle or the Polis. It wasn't just a matter of the complicated hydroponic equipment required to grow the seeds that had been saved. There was also the fact that not many stations in the metro could afford to spend kilowatts of energy on varying their soldiers' diet. Even the top command's tables were only graced with vegetables on holidays. Usually the children were the only ones who were pampered like that. It had cost Istomin a serious quarrel with the chefs to get them to add boiled potatoes and a tomato to each of their portions of pork that were due on uneven dates in order to keep up their soldiers' morale. The trick worked. The moment that Nadia, with typical female awkwardness, dropped the submachine gun off her shoulder in order to lift the lid of the casserole, the sentry's wrinkled faces started relaxing and smoothing out. No one wanted to spoil a supper like this with sour, tedious talk about the convoy that had disappeared and the overdue reconnaissance team.
I don't know why, but I've been thinking about Komsomol Station all day today,
said a grey-haired old man wearing a quilted jacket with Moscow Metro shoulder badges as he squished potatoes in his aluminium bowl.
If I could just get there and take a look. The mosaics they have there. To my mind, it's the most beautiful station in Moscow. Ah, drop it, Homer. You probably used to live there and you still love it to this day, retorted a fat, unshaven man in a cap with ear flaps.
What about the stained glass at Novoslobodskaya, and those light, airy columns at Mayakovsky Station with the frescoes on the ceiling?
I like Revolution Square best,
a sniper confessed shyly. He was a quiet, serious man getting on in years.
I know it's all stupid nonsense, but those stern-looking sailors and airmen, those border guards with their dogs— I've adored that station ever since I was a kid.
What's so stupid about it? There are some very nice-looking men depicted in bronze there,
Nadia said, backing him up in as she scraped the remains off the bottom of the casserole.
Hey, Brigadier, look sharp, or you'll be left with no supper.
The tall, broad-shouldered warrior who had been sitting apart from the others strolled over unhurriedly to the campfire, took his serving and went back to his spot, closer to the tunnel, as far away as possible from the men.
Does he ever show up at the station?
The fat man asked in a whisper, nodding in the direction of the massively broad back, half hidden in the semi-darkness.
He hasn't moved from this place for more than a week now,
the sniper replied in an equally quiet voice.
Spends the night in a sleeping bag. I don't know how his nerves can stand it, or maybe he just enjoys the whole thing. 3 days ago, when the Upirs almost did for Rinat, he went round afterwards and finished them off. By hand. Took about 15 minutes doing it. Came back with his boots covered in blood. Delighted with himself.
He's a machine, not a man,
a lanky machine gunner put in.
I'm afraid even to sleep beside him. Have you seen what a mess his face is? I don't even want to look in his eyes.
But I only feel calm when I'm with him,
the old man called Homer said with a shrug.
What are you running him down for? He's a good man, just got maimed, that's all. It's only the stations that need to be beautiful. And that Novoslobodskaya of yours, by the way, is just plain tawdry, bad taste. There's no way you can look at all that colored glass unless you're drunk. stained glass rubbish.
And collective farm mosaics, covering half the ceiling, aren't in bad taste then?
Where did you find any pictures like that at Komsomol Station?
Why, all that damn Soviet art is about collective farm life or heroic airmen, said the fat man, starting to get heated.
Seryoza, you lay off the airmen,
the sniper warned him.
Komsomol Station's garbage. And Novoslobodskaya's shit.
They heard a dull, low voice say. The fat man was so surprised he choked on the words that were already on the tip of his tongue and gaped at the brigadier. The others immediately fell silent, too, waiting to see what would come next. The brigadier almost never joined in their conversations. He even answered direct questions curtly or didn't bother to answer at all. He was still sitting with his back to them, with his eyes fixed on the gaping mouth of the tunnel.
The vaults at Komsomol are too high, and the columns are too thin. The entire platform can be raked with fire from the tracks. It's wide open, and closing off the pedestrian passages is too tricky. And at Novoslobodskaya, the walls are a mass of cracks, no matter how hard they try to plaster over them. One grenade would be enough to bring the whole station down. And there haven't been any stained glass panels there for ages. They're all broken. That stuff's too fragile.
No one dared to object. The brigadier paused for a moment and blurted out,
I'm going to the station, and I'm taking Homer with me. The watch will change in an hour. Arthur's in charge here.
The sniper jumped to his feet and nodded, even though the brigadier couldn't see it. The old man also got up and started bustling about, collecting his scattered bits and pieces into his knapsack without even finishing his potatoes. The warrior walked up to the campfire, fully kitted out for an expedition, with his eternal helmet and a bulky knapsack behind his shoulders. Good luck. Watching the two figures as they receded, the brigadier's mighty frame and Homer's skinny one, the sniper rubbed his hands together, as if he felt cold, and cringed.
It's getting a bit chilly. Throw on a bit of coal, will you?
The brigadier didn't utter a single word all the way, apart from asking if it was true that Homer used to be an engine driver's mate, and before that a simple track walker. The old man gave him a suspicious glance, but he didn't try to deny it, even though he had always told everyone at Sebastopol that he had risen to the rank of engine driver and preferred not to dwell on the fact that he used to be a track dweller, believing it wasn't really worth mentioning. The brigadier walked into the station commandant's office without knocking, saluting the sentry stiffly as they moved aside. Istomin and the colonel, both looking tired, disheveled and bewildered, got up from the desk in surprise when he entered. Homer halted timidly in the door, shifting from one foot to the other. The brigadier pulled off his helmet and set it down on Istomin's papers, then ran one hand over the clean-shaven back of his head. The light of the lamp revealed how terribly his face was mutilated. The left cheek was furrowed and twisted into a huge scar, as if it had been burned. The eye had been reduced to a narrow slit, and a thick purple weal squirmed its way down from his ear to the corner of his mouth. Homer thought he had grown used to this face, but looking at it now, he felt the same chilly, repulsive, prickling sensation as the first time.
I'll go to the circle,
the brigadier blurted out, dispensing with any kind of greeting. A heavy silence descended on the room. Homer had heard the brigadier was on special terms with the command of the station because he was so irreplaceable in combat. But only now did the realization dawn that, unlike all the other Sebastopolites, this man didn't seem to defer to the commanders at all. And at this moment, he didn't seem to be waiting for the approval of these two elderly, jaded men, but simply giving them an order that they were obliged to carry out. Which made Homer wonder yet again just who this man was. The perimeter commander exchanged glances with his superior and frowned, about to object, but instead merely gestured helplessly.
You decide for yourself, Hunter. It's pointless trying to argue with you.
Chapter 2 The Return. The old man hovering by the door pricked up his ears. He hadn't heard that name before at Sebastopol Station. Not even a name, but a nickname, like he had. He wasn't really called Homer, of course, he was just Commoner Garden Nikolai Ivanovich, who had been named after the Greek teller of myths here at the station, for his irrepressible love of all sorts of stories and rumors.
"Your new brigadier,"
the colonel had said to the watchmen who were examining with morose curiosity this broad-shouldered newcomer clad in Kevlar and a heavy helmet. Ignoring basic courtesy, he turned away indifferently. The tunnel and the fortifications seemed to interest him far more than the men entrusted to his command. He shook the hands of his new subordinates when they came up to make his acquaintance, but he didn't introduce himself, nodding without speaking, committing each new nickname to memory, and puffing out bluish, acrid cigarette smoke into their faces to demarcate the limits of closeness. In the shadow of the raised visor, his narrow, gun-slit eye, framed by scars, had a ghastly, lackluster gleam to it. None of the watchmen had dared to insist on knowing his name, either then or later, and so for 2 months now they had been calling him simply Brigadier. They decided the station must have shelled out for one of those expensive mercenaries who could manage perfectly well without a past or a name. Hunter. Homer silently worked the strange, un-Russian word around on his tongue. Better suited for a Central Asian shepherd dog than a man. He smiled gently to himself. Well, well, so he still remembered that there used to be dogs like that. Where did all this stuff in his head come from? A fighting breed with a short, docked tail and ears clipped right in close to the head. Nothing superfluous. And the name, if he kept repeating it to himself for a while, started sounding vaguely familiar. Where could he have heard it before? Borne along on an endless stream of gossip and tall stories, it had snagged his attention somehow and then settled on the very bottom of his memory. And now it was overlaid with a thick layer of silt. Names, facts, rumors, numbers, all that useless information about other people's lives that Homer listened to with such avid curiosity— and tried so zealously to remember. Hunter. Maybe some jailbird with a reward from Hansa on his head. The old man tossed the idea like a stone into the deep millpond of his amnesia and listened. No. Nothing. A stalker. He didn't seem like one. A warlord? More like it, and a legendary one, apparently. Homer cast another stealthy glance at the brigadier's face, so impassive that it seemed almost paralyzed. That dog's name suited him remarkably well.
"I need a team of 3 men. I'll take Homer. He knows the tunnels around here,"
the brigadier went on, without even turning towards the old man or asking his permission.
"You can give me another man you think will suit. A runner. A courier. I'll set out today."
Istomin jerked his head hastily in approval, before he gathered his wits and raised his eyes inquiringly to look at the colonel. The colonel frowned and muttered gruffly that he had no objections either, although for days he had been battling desperately with the station commandant for every free soldier. It seemed like no one intended to consult Homer, but he didn't even think of arguing. Despite his age, the old man had never refused this kind of assignment. And he had his reasons for that. The brigadier snatched his immensely heavy helmet up off the desk and headed towards the exit. Lingering in the doorway for a moment, he said brusquely to Homer,
"Say goodbye to your family. Pack for a long journey. Don't bring any bullets. I'll give you those."
And he disappeared through the opening. The old man set off after him, hoping to hear at least some basic explanation about what he should expect on this expedition. But when he emerged onto the platform, Hunter was already way ahead, 10 of his massive strides away, and Homer didn't even try to catch up with him, but just shook his head and watched him go. Contrary to his usual habit, the brigadier had left his head uncovered, perhaps lost in thoughts of other things he had forgotten, or perhaps he was feeling a need for air right now. He passed a gaggle of young women, pig herders idling away their lunch break, and there was a whisper of disgust behind his back.
Oh, girls, my God, what a repulsive freak.
Where the hell did you dig him up from?
Asked Istomin, slumping back limply in his chair in relief and reaching out his plump hand to a pile of cut cigarette papers. People said the leaves that were smoked with such relish at the station were gathered by the stalkers at some spot on the surface, almost as far away as Bitsevsky Park. Once, for a joke, the colonel had held a radiation dosimeter to a packet of tobacco, and it had started chattering away menacingly. The old man had given up smoking on the spot, and the cough that had been tormenting him at night, terrifying him with thoughts of lung cancer, had gradually started to ease. But Istomin had refused to believe the story of the radioactive leaves, reminding Denis Mikhailovich with good reason that in the metro, absolutely anything you picked up was more or less hot.
"We are old acquaintances,"
the colonel replied reluctantly. Then he paused and threw in,
"He didn't used to be like this. Something happened to him." "That's for sure. If his face is anything to go by, something definitely happened to him."
The commandant snorted and immediately glanced towards the door, as if Hunter could have been loitering there and overheard him by chance. The commander of the defensive perimeter had no right to grumble about the brigadier's unexpected return from out of the cold mists of the past. From the moment he showed up at the station, he had effectively become the backbone of the perimeter's defense. But even now, Denis Mikhailovich couldn't entirely believe that he had come back. The news of Hunter's strange and terrible death had flashed round the metro the previous year, like an echo racing through the tunnels. And when Hunter turned up on the doorstep of the colonel's little room 2 months ago, the colonel had hastily crossed himself before opening the door. The suspicious ease with which the resurrected man had passed through the guard posts, as if he had walked straight through the soldiers there, made the colonel doubt that this miracle was entirely benign. Through the steamed-up spy-hole of the door, he saw what seemed to be a familiar profile. A bull neck, a cranium scraped so smooth that it shone, a slightly flattened nose. But for some reason, the nocturnal visitor had frozen in semi-profile, with his head lowered, and he didn't make any attempt to lighten the heavy silence. Casting a reproachful glance at the large, open bottle of homebrew beer standing on the table, the colonel heaved a deep sigh and pulled back the bolt. The honor code required him to help his own, and it drew no distinctions between the living and the dead. When the door swung open, Hunter looked up from the floor, making it clear why he had been hiding the other half of his face. He was afraid the other man simply wouldn't recognize him. Even a hard-boiled veteran like the old colonel, for whom the command of the Sebastopol garrison was like honorary retirement on a pension, compared with the turbulent years that came before it, winced when he saw that face, as if he had burned his fingers, and then started laughing guiltily. He couldn't help himself. His visitor didn't even smile in reply. Over the months, the terrible scars that mutilated his face had healed over slightly. But even so, almost nothing about him reminded the colonel of the old Hunter. He flatly refused to explain his miraculous escape or why he had been missing for so long, and simply didn't answer any of the colonel's questions, as if he hadn't even heard them. And worst of all, Hunter presented Denis Mikhailovich with an old debt for repayment, and made him promise not to tell anyone that he had shown up. The colonel had been obliged to leave Hunter in peace and stifle his own common-sense reaction, which cried out for him to inform his commander immediately. The old man had, however, made some cautious inquiries. His visitor was not implicated in anything shady, and no one was looking for him anymore after his funeral rites had been read so long ago. His body, admittedly, had never been found, but if Hunter had survived, someone would certainly have heard from him. The colonel was confidently informed. Definitely, he agreed. On the other hand, as often happens when people disappear without a trace, Hunter, or rather his simultaneously blurred and embellished image, had surfaced in at least a dozen myths and legends that had the ring of half-truth about them. Apparently this role suited him just fine, and he was in no hurry at all to disabuse the comrades who had buried him so prematurely. Bearing in mind his unpaid debts and drawing the appropriate conclusions, Denis Mikhailovich had kept his mouth shut and even started playing along. He avoided calling Hunter by name in the presence of outsiders and let Istomin in on the secret, but without going into detail. It was basically all the same to Istomin. The brigadier earned his issue of rations in spades, spending all his time day and night on the front line in the southern tunnels. He was hardly ever spotted at the station, where he put in an appearance once a week on his bath day. And even if he had only jumped into this hellhole so that he could hide there from unknown pursuers, that didn't bother Istomin, who had never been squeamish about employing the services of legionaries with dark pasts, just as long as he was a fighter, and there were no problems on that score. The soldiers of the watch had grumbled among themselves about their new commander, but they stopped after the first engagement. Once they saw the cold, methodical, inhuman euphoria with which he annihilated everything they were supposed to annihilate, they all understood his true value. No one tried to make friends with the unsociable brigadier any longer, but they obeyed him implicitly, so he never needed to raise his dull, cracked voice. There was something hypnotic about that voice. Even the station commandant started nodding dutifully every time Hunter spoke to him, without even waiting for him to finish. For no special reason, it was simply an automatic response. For the first time in recent days, it felt easier to breathe in Istomin's office, as if a silent thunderstorm had swept through it, relieving the tension in the air and bringing welcome release. There was nothing left to argue about. There was no finer warrior than Hunter. If he disappeared in the tunnels, the Sebastopolites would be left with only one choice.
"Shall I give instructions to prepare for the operation?" asked the colonel, bringing up the subject first, because he knew the station commandant would want to talk about it anyway. 3 days ought to be enough for you," said Istomin, clicking his cigarette lighter and screwing up his eyes. "We won't be able to wait for them any longer than that. How many men will we need? What do you think?" "We've got one assault brigade awaiting orders. I can handle the other men. There's another 20 or so. If by the day after tomorrow we haven't heard anything about them..."
The colonel jerked his head in the direction of the door.
"Declare a general mobilization. We'll break out."
Istomin raised his eyebrows, but instead of objecting, he took a deep drag on his cigarette, which cracked faintly. Denis Mikhailovich raked together several well-scribbled sheets of paper that were lying around on the desk, leaned down over them short-sightedly, and started sketching mysterious diagrams, writing surnames and nicknames inside little circles. "Break out." The station commandant looked through the drifting tobacco smoke over the back of the colonel's head at the large schematic map of the metro hanging behind the old man's back. Yellowed and greasy, covered with markings in ink, arrows for forced marches, rings for ambushes, little stars for guard posts, and exclamation marks for forbidden zones. The map was a chronicle of the last decade, 10 years during which not a single day had passed peacefully. Below Sebastopol, the marks broke off immediately beyond Southern Station. Istomin couldn't remember anyone ever coming back from there. The line crept on downwards, like a long, branching route, immaculately chased all the way. The Serpukhov line had proved too tough a nut for the Sebastopolites to crack, even if the entire toothless, radiation-sick human population combined its most desperate efforts, it probably wouldn't be enough down there. And now, a white, swirling fog of uncertainty had obscured the stub end of their line that reached obstinately northwards to Hansa, to the human race. Tomorrow, none of the men that the colonel ordered to prepare for battle would refuse to fight. The war for the extinction or survival of humankind, begun more than 2 decades ago, had never stopped for a moment at Sebastopol. When you live by side with death for many years, the fear of dying gives way to indifference, fatalism, superstitions, protective amulets, and animal instincts. But who knew what was waiting for them up ahead, between the Nakhimov Prospekt and Serpukhov stations? Who knew if it was even possible to break through this mysterious barrier, and if there was anywhere to break through to? He recalled his latest trip to Serpukhov station, market stalls, tramps, makeshift beds, and dilapidated screens behind which the slightly better-off inhabitants slept and made love to each other. They didn't produce any food of their own. There were no hothouse chambers for growing plants, no pens for cattle. The nimble-footed, light-fingered Serpukhovites fed themselves from profiteering, reselling old surplus goods picked up for a song from convoy merchants who were running behind schedule, and by providing citizens of the Circle Line with services for which those citizens would have faced trial at home. Not a station, but a fungus, a parasitic growth on the mighty trunk of Hansa. The alliance of rich trading stations on the Circle Line, aptly dubbed Hansa, in memory of its Teutonic prototype, was an enduring bulwark of civilization in a metro that was sinking into a swamp of barbarity and poverty. Hansa was a regular army, electric lighting even at the poorest way station, and a guaranteed crust of bread for everyone whose passport contained the coveted stamp of citizenship. On the black market, passports like that cost an absolute fortune, but if Hanseatic border guards discovered anyone with a counterfeit, the price he paid was his head. Of course, Hansa owed its wealth and power to its location. The Circle Line ringed the central tangle of radial lines with its transfer stations, allowing access to all of them and harnessing them together. Shuttle traders carrying tea from the Economic Achievement Station and trolleys delivering ammunition from the arms factories at Baumann Station preferred to offload their goods at the closest Hansa post and go back home. Better to let the goods go cheap than set off right round the metro in pursuit of profit, on a journey that could be cut short at any moment. Hansa had annexed some of the adjacent radial line stations, but most of them had been left to themselves and become transformed with Hansa's connivance into grey areas, where people conducted the kind of business in which the disdainful bosses of Hansa preferred not to be implicated. Naturally, the radial transfer stations were flooded with Hansa's spies, and they had been bought lock, stock and barrel by its merchants, but they remained nominally independent. Serpukhov station was one of these. A train had halted forever in one of the stretches of line leading from it after failing to reach the next station, Tula. Rendered habitable by the Protestant sectarian believers who now occupied it, the train was indicated on Istomin's map with a laconic Latin cross. It had become an isolated homestead, lost in a black wasteland. If not for the missionaries roaming round the neighboring stations with their insatiable greed for lost souls, Istomin wouldn't have had any complaints about the sectarians. But in any case, these sheepdogs of God didn't roam as far as Sebastopol, and they didn't cause any particular hindrance to passing travelers, except perhaps by delaying them slightly with their intense conversations about salvation. And apart from that, the other tunnel from Tula to Serpukhov was entirely clear, so the local convoys used that one. Istomin ran his glance down the line again. Tula Station, a settlement gradually running to seed, picking up the crumbs dropped by Sebastopolite convoys marching through and the sly traders from Serpukhov. The people lived on whatever they could turn their hand to. Some mended various sorts of mechanical junk, some went to the Hansa border to look for work, squatting on their haunches for days at a time, waiting for the next foreman with the high-handed manners of a slave driver.
They live poorly, too, but they don't have that slippery, villainous Serpukhov look in their eyes, thought Istomin, and there is a lot more order there. It's probably the danger that binds them together.
The next station, Nagatina, was marked on his map with a short stroke of the pen. Empty. A half-truth. No one loitered there for long, but sometimes there was a motley swarm of rabble at the station, leading a subhuman twilight existence. Couples who had fled from prying eyes twined their limbs together in the pitch darkness. Sometimes the glow of a feeble little campfire sprang up among the columns with the shadows of tunnel bandits and murderers swarming around it. But only the ignorant or the absolutely desperate stayed here overnight. By no means all the station's visitors were human. If you stared hard into the trembling, whispering gloom that filled Nagatina, You could sometimes glimpse silhouettes straight out of a nightmare. And every now and then, the homeless vagabonds scattered, if only briefly, when a blood-curdling howl rang through the stale air as some poor soul was dragged off into a lair to be devoured at leisure. The tramps didn't dare set foot beyond Nagatino, and from there all the way to the defensive boundaries of Sebastopol, it was no man's land. A strictly notional name, of course, the area had its own masters, who guarded its boundaries, and even the Sebastopolite reconnaissance teams preferred not to come up against them. But now, something new had appeared in the tunnels. Something unprecedented, swallowing up everyone who tried to follow a route that supposedly had been thoroughly explored long ago. And who knew if Istomin Station, even if it called on every inhabitant who was fit to bear arms, would be able to marshal a force strong enough to overcome it. Istomin got up laboriously off his chair, shuffled over to the map and marked with an indelible pencil the stretch of line running from the point called Serpukhov to the point labeled Nahimov Prospekt. He drew a thick question mark beside it. He meant to put it beside the Prospekt, but it ended up right beside Sebastopol. At first glance, Sebastopol station appeared deserted. On the platform there was no sign of the familiar army tents in which people usually lived at other stations. There were only forms vaguely perceived by the light of a few dim bulbs, the anthill profiles of machine gun emplacements built out of sandbags, but the firing positions were empty, and dust lay thick on the slim square columns. Everything was arranged to make sure that if an outsider found his way in here, he would be certain to think the station had been abandoned long ago. However, if the uninvited guest got the idea of lingering here, even for a short while, he risked staying forever. The machine-gun squads and snipers on 24-hour duty in adjacent Kakhovka station occupied their positions in those emplacements in a matter of seconds, and the weak light was drowned in the pitiless glare of mercury lamps on the ceiling, searing the retinal nerves of men and monsters accustomed to the darkness of the tunnels. The platform was the Sebastopolites' final, most comprehensively planned line of defense. Their homes were located in the belly of this stage set, in the technical area under the platform. Below the granite slabs of the floor, hidden away from the prying eyes of strangers, was another story with a floor area as large as the main hall, but divided up into numerous compartments. Well-lit, dry, warm rooms, smoothly humming machines for purifying air and water, hydroponic hothouses. When they retreated down here, even further underground, the station's inhabitants were enfolded in a sense of security and comfort. Homer knew the decisive battle he would face was not in the northern tunnels, but at home. He made his way along the narrow corridor, past the half-open doors of other people's apartments, dragging his feet slower and slower as he approached his own door. He needed to think through his tactics one more time and rehearse his lines. He was running out of time.
"What can I do about it? It's an order. You know what the situation's like. They didn't even bother to ask me. Stop acting like a little child. That's just plain ridiculous. Of course I didn't ask to be taken. I can't do that. What are you saying? Of course I can't. Refuse? That's desertion,"
he mumbled to himself, switching between determined outrage and a wheedling, cajoling, affectionate tone. When he reached the doorway of his room, he started mumbling it all over again. No, there was no way tears could be avoided, but he wasn't going to back down. The old man pulled his head into his shoulders, readying himself for battle, and turned down the door handle. 9.5 square meters of floor space, a great luxury that he had spent 5 years waiting in line for, shifting about from one dormitory to another. 2 square meters were taken up by a 2-tier army bunk bed and one by a dining table covered with an elegant tablecloth. Another 3 were occupied by a huge heap of newspapers, reaching right up to the ceiling. If he had been a solitary bachelor, then one fine day this mountain would certainly have collapsed, burying him underneath it. But 15 years earlier, he had met a woman who was not only prepared to tolerate this huge pile of dusty junk in her tiny home, but even willing to keep it neat and tidy so that it wouldn't transform her domestic nest into a paper Pompeii. She was prepared to tolerate very many things. The interminable newspaper cuttings with alarming headlines like Arms Race Heats Up, Americans Test New Anti-Rocket Defense, Our Nuclear Shield is Growing Stronger, Provocative Acts Continue, and Our Patience is Exhausted, which covered the walls of the little room like wallpaper from top to bottom. His all-night sessions hunched over a heap of school exercise books with a well-chewed ballpoint pen in his hand and the electric light burning, with a heap of paper like that in their home, candles were completely out of the question. His humorous, clownish nickname, which he bore with pride and others spoke, with a condescending smile. Very many things, but not everything. Not his juvenile urge to plunge into the epicenter of the hurricane every time in order to see what things were really like in there, and this at the age of almost 60. And not the frivolity with which he accepted any assignment from his superiors, forgetting that he had barely escaped with his life and managed to scramble back home after one of his recent expeditions. Not the thought that she might lose him and be left all alone again. After seeing Homer off to the watch, his turn to stand duty came round once a week. She never stayed at home. To escape from her distressing thoughts, she called on neighbors or went to work even when it wasn't her shift. The male indifference to death seemed stupid, egotistic, and criminal to her. It was pure chance that he found her at home. She had dropped in to change after work, and now she froze just as she was, with her arms threaded into the sleeves of her darned woolen sweater, her dark hair, visibly streaked with grey, although she wasn't even 50 yet, was tangled, her brown eyes were bright with fear.
Kolya, has something happened? Aren't you on duty until late?
Homer suddenly lost all desire to tell her about the decision that had been taken. He hesitated. Maybe if he just calmed her down for the time being, he could slip the news into the talk over dinner.
Only, don't you even think of lying,
she warned him, catching his wondering gaze.
You know, Lena, the thing is, he began.
Has someone...
She asked the most important question immediately about the most terrible thing of all, not wishing even to pronounce the word died, as if she believed her dark thoughts might materialize as reality.
No, no, said Homer with a shake of his head. They just took me off duty. They're sending me to Serpukhov, he added in a matter-of-fact voice.
But isn't...
Elena said, and faltered.
Isn't that... Have they come back then? That's where...
Oh, come on. It's all a load of nonsense. There's nothing there, he said hastily.
Elena turned away, walked over to the table, shifted the salt cellar from one spot to another, and straightened out a fold in the tablecloth.
I had a dream,
she said, and coughed to clear the hoarseness out of her voice.
You have them all the time.
A bad dream,
she went on stubbornly, and suddenly broke into pitiful sobs.
Oh, come on now, what can I do? It's an order, he mumbled, stroking her fingers and floundering as he realized his entire well-prepared speech wasn't worth a damn.
May that one-eyed bastard go himself!
She yelled furiously through her tears, jerking her hand away.
Let that other fiend go in his little beret. All they ever do is give orders. What does he care? All his life he slept with a machine gun beside him instead of a woman. What does he know?
Once you've reduced a woman to tears, you can only demean yourself by turning round and trying to console her. Homer felt ashamed and genuinely sorry for Elena. But it would have been all too easy now to break down, promise to refuse the assignment, reassure her and dry her tears, only to regret later missing his chance. This chance that had fallen to him, which could be the last one in a life that was already unusually long by today's standards. So he said nothing. It was already time to go, gather the officers together and brief them. But the colonel carried on sitting in his Stormin's office, taking no notice of the cigarette smoke that usually irritated and tempted him so badly. While the station commandant whispered something thoughtfully, running one finger over his battle-scarred map of the metro, Denis Mikhailovich kept trying to understand why Hunter wanted to do this. There could be only one thing behind his mysterious appearance at Sebastopol: his desire to settle here, and even the cautious way in which the brigadier almost always showed up at the station, wearing his helmet to conceal his face. Istomin must be right. Hunter was on the run from someone after all. In order to earn extra points, he had made the Southern Guard post his base. By doing the work of an entire brigade, he was gradually making himself indispensable. At this stage, no matter who demanded that they hand him over, no matter what reward they offered for his head, neither Istomin nor the colonel would even think of letting them have him. He had chosen the perfect place to hide. There were no outsiders at Sebastopol, and unlike the garrulous shuttled traders from other stations, the local convoy merchants weren't loose-tongued. They never gossiped when they got out into the greater metro. In this little Sparta, clinging to its patch of earth at the very end of the world, the qualities valued most highly were reliability and ferocity in battle. And people here knew how to keep secrets. But then why would Hunter abandon everything, volunteer for this expedition, and set out for Hansa, risking being recognized? Even Istomin wouldn't have had the heart to assign him a sortie like this. Somehow the colonel didn't believe the brigadier was really alarmed about the fate of the missing scouts, and he wasn't fighting for Sebastopol out of love for the station, but for reasons of his own, known only to him. Maybe he was on a mission. That would explain a lot: his sudden arrival, his secrecy, the obstinacy with which he spent the nights in a sleeping bag in the tunnels, his decision to set out for Serpukhov station immediately. But then why had he asked the colonel not to let anyone else know? Who could have sent him if not them? Who else? The colonel forced himself to ignore the desire to take a drag from Istomin's cigarette. No, it was impossible. Hunter, one of the pillars of the order, the man to whom tens, maybe hundreds of them, owed their lives, including Denis Mikhailovich himself.
"That man couldn't," he objected cautiously to himself. "But was the hunter who returned from the abyss still that man?"
And if he was acting on instructions from someone, could he have received some kind of signal now? Did this mean that the disappearance of the armaments convoys and the three scouts was no coincidence, but part of a carefully planned operation? But then what part was the brigadier playing in it? The colonel shook his head briskly to and fro, as if he were trying to toss off the leeches of doubt that had fastened onto it and were rapidly swelling up with blood. How could he think like this about a man who had saved his life, especially since so far Hunter had served the station in